I'm speaking today with David Correa, assistant professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and author of the new book, Properties of Violence, Law and Land Grant Struggle in Northern New Mexico. He'll be speaking about his new book this Sunday as part of the Journey Santa Fe series at 11 a.m. at Collected Works. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, David.
Thank you for having me.
So this weekend I drove up to Colorado and I passed that familiar sign in Tierra Maria, the sign that says Tierra o Muerte with a picture of Zapata and Viva Zapata, and I thought this really symbolizes the north of New Mexico for sure and land grant struggles in particular. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to write this book and explain these land grant struggles for people who get a little confused by them?
Sure, that's a big question.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Well, that sign that you mentioned that most people who've driven up there have seen is actually marks the site of a struggle in the late 1980s, early 1990s. It was a 14-month standoff that serves as part of the last chapter in the book that I examine that struggle for land. It was between land-grant heirs and an Arizona development company. And if you talk to land-grant activists up there, they'll say that's the only liberated part of the land-grant. They won 230 acres in a court settlement in, I think, early 1990s. But the book, as I told my publisher when I was finishing the book starts in 1776 and finishes like last Wednesday. And that sort of, a tongue-in-cheek way of saying that the land-grant it's not land-grant history, it's a land-grant struggle that continues and goes on. And part of the reason why I wrote the book was because I think that much of the history of New Mexico's Spanish and Mexican period is often told as this sort of dead history that doesn't really have anything to do with any of the political issues that go on today. And I think that it does, and it's very important. So, and in particular, the Tierra Maria land-grant is probably the most notorious struggle in New Mexican history, the longest lasting, the one that every now and then erupts in armed struggle between land-grant heirs or claimants and various private ranchers or the state. It's just a great story, and I wanted to tell that story because it also provided a way to really get into the messy, complicated history in New Mexico that I think interrupts the usual tricultural myth of New Mexico, that, oh, we have this tricultural history and everyone lives in harmony and isn't it wonderful? And it also, I wanted to interrupt the idea that this common critique against New Mexico Spanish and Mexican land-grant activists, when they make a claim for land, a common criticism of them and those claims are, well, you were conquered at one time, but then you became the conquerors. You first were conquerors and then were conquered. And Tierra Maria is a much more complicated story. The people that moved north from Abiquiú in the 1800s into TA were people from, the poor settlers, landless sheep herders. Many of them were Janisero Indians that for parents or grandparents had been kidnapped in sort of the slave trade that dominated the 18th and early 19th century in New Mexico between both Spanish settlers and Apaches and Utes and others. So it's a simplification to say that this is a Mexican land grant. It's really a much more complicated story.
Well, and you talk about these settlers almost being used as a tool for colonization to kind of push forward and clear the land almost to meet with the Utes and the Apaches,
right,
and kind of do the dirty work for colonization.
Yeah, I think that often one of the criticisms I have of some land-grant histories is that you can't see the forest for the trees in these stories.
Right.
And it's such an interesting story, and the details are so fascinating. But the larger picture is important. And what was happening when Spain was moving north, they were far weaker militarily than the Apaches, the Utes, the Navajos, particularly the Comanches. And so they had to establish these buffer zones between them and the really valuable mining regions south of Santa Fe. And so the best way to do that was just to launch these poor landless settlers into northern New Mexico in places like Abiquiú and eventually Tierra Maria, Petaca, Vallecitos, in the Taos area. And, these are people that were living in the barrios in Santa Fe or were landless sheep herders in the north and desperate for land. and willing to be, frankly, cannon fodder in the really a ferocious war, particularly in the 1840s, between the Mexicans and the Ute tribe. So when we talk today about land-grant heirs, we're not talking about conquerors, I think. I think we're talking about people who have a connection to settlers, who have much more in common with the Utes they moved out, or the Apaches they moved out, than the wealthy elites in Santa Fe that sent them north in the first place.
Well, that's almost phase two, right, when the Santa Fe Ring came in. These settlers who came, was there some kind of agreement? I mean, you talk about the dispossession occurring because of contradictions in property law, too. What was the understanding? I mean, these people were told, if you can get rid of the Native Americans living there, you can have this piece of community property?
Well, right. Spanish and Mexican colonization law required that only lands that were empty, right, could be colonized. But, of course, in practice, that didn't happen. So, for example, Tierra Maria was Ute land. I mean, it was actively used as hunting lands by the Utes. In fact, when the United States arrived in 1846, the only people living in Tierra Maria were Utes. Even into the early 1860s, the only people living in the Tierra Maria area were Utes. So the Mexican settlers, or at least the settlers who claimed the Mexican land grant to Tierra Maria. And by the way, Tierra Maria, if you're not familiar, goes into what's present-day Colorado, and it's about a 600,000-acre land grant.
Wow.
in north-central New Mexico, and into a small portion in Colorado. So, you know, there was this low-grade conflict between Utes and these settlers to acquire these properties. But in the book, the reason why I call it Properties of Violence is because it's really a story about claims to property, right? And this notion that Mexican and Spanish land grants were organized around common property, and that this influx of Anglo settlers and speculators organized themselves around this idea of private property. And the usual story of the dispossession of land grants in New Mexico is that it just happened because of a collision, this legal collision, that they were incompatible and incommensurable. And because of that, these common property claims were swamped by speculators and courts who recognized only private property. And that's it's also a simplification, because as I show in the book, in Tierra Maria, although the courts time and time again found that common property relations, though they existed for generations, had no legal standing, in practice, every day, people just used the land the way they did, really into the 1970s. And that created conflicts, obviously, between private claimants and former land grant heirs. So I'm trying to interrupt the idea in the book, too, that there was just some collision in the 19th century, and all the land grants were lost. That's usually the story. Oh, the land grants were lost to these speculators. But in reality, particularly in Tierra Maria, that struggle continued into the 1990s, and in some ways still does today, which is the epilogue of the book. I'm trying to understand how this is playing out today, related to like real estate speculation and upscale development in the mountains above TA.
I mean, some of the interesting philosophical notion of violence is you seem to write about law being legitimized through violence. I mean, it's almost, or it seemed, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the courts had one place in terms of validating a law, but that violence superseded all of that. And that it's almost like whoever had the biggest guns kind of got the most land, which is kind of the history of this world, basically. But
well, and usually the people with the biggest guns are the state. And
right.
So
right.
The violence in the book is really the violence of the state. And what I'm suggesting here, and I'm not the first to suggest it, but is that, you know, to claim that we have something and that we rely on called private property, that doesn't just imply violence. It requires it. In order for private property to exist as an exclusive object that's owned by a person or corporation, for example, it has to be enforced. And that enforcement includes violence in order to bring it to life. And so in the book, I think I'm trying to examine the ways in which the state not only constructs private property relations in a way to replace the common property relations that preceded them, but also how those get enforced. And it's violent. And so, you know, one of the chapters in the book is about the FBI and the New Mexico State Police, who spend decades surveilling land-grant activists. J. Edgar Hoover himself supervised the surveillance of land-grant activists, including Reyes Lopez Tijerina. the New Mexico State Police carried out violent programs against activists in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and I accessed this through Freedom of Information Act requests and interviews, and was able to document this history of violence against those that were making claims against private property.
So I'm speaking today with David Correa, assistant professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico, about his new book, Properties of Violence, about land grants in northern New Mexico. You mentioned Tijerina, and it seems one of the best-known kind of land-grant confrontation was this Rio Arriba courthouse raid in 67. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think if anyone knows anything at all about the Tijerina land grant, it's probably the 1967 courthouse raid in which Reyes Lopez Tijerina, who founded a group called Alianza Federal de Mercedes with his brother in the early 60s, raided the courthouse in Rio Arriba in TA. The idea was he was going to put the district attorney, Alfonso Sanchez, who, by the way, lives in Santa Fe, and I hope he's listening. I interviewed him for the book. Because Sanchez was trying to interrupt the efforts of Alianza and Tijerina to make these claims for land grants, most of which are now national forest. The raid went horribly wrong, and it became a gunfight, and Tijerina went from this little-known figure in northern New Mexico to a national civil rights hero in a lot of circles, and spent the years after traveling the country at Black Panther rallies and going to visit with Elijah Muhammad, and was invited to the Poor People's March in Washington, D.C. to sit in for a slain Martin Luther King. It became a really important figure. And
which also caught the attention of J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, even earlier than that. Tijerina had caught the attention of Hoover. And in fact, even before the courthouse raid, Hoover was briefing the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and local law enforcement departments in New Mexico, claiming that Tijerina was an agent of foreign powers. But the thing about the book is, it's such an interesting story, and as fascinating as Tijerina is, it's not even the most interesting thing about the Tijerina land grant struggle in the years before, the years after. It's fascinating, right? I mean, this idea that far from being this backwater in sort of civic life in the United States, New Mexico became this key center of like struggle among people like J. Edgar Hoover. In the 70s, the FBI was convinced that Tijerina was the center of Chicano militancy in the U.S. and was connected to the bombings by the FALN, the Puerto Rican Nationalist Group in New York, that was bombing buildings in New York and Chicago in the early 70s, and spent years surveilling, trying to figure out what is this connection between TA and Puerto Rico. In fact, as late as 2005, the domestic terrorism unit of the FBI was still considering whether and flying planes.
Wow.
I found this in a Freedom of Information Act request to try to figure out, is this still going on in TA? So it's this fascinating story that's very little known. Usually land grant stories are like, oh, it happened in the past and it ended in like 1890, and then nothing happens until all of a sudden this guy, Tijerina, emerges in 67. But when we look at TA, we see that in the early 20s, this group called La Mano Negra, this secret group of fence cutters, emerges to try to eject private ranchers. And then in the 30s, apparently the Ku Klux Klan arrives, which is one of the chapters that I write
about. Yeah, can you elaborate on that? That was probably one of the more bizarre details that I found in your book.
Yeah, there was a long period of legal struggle from the 30s into the 60s. But just before that, there was what you would have to call an armed insurrection in TA, in which people were burning out private ranchers and shooting their livestock and cutting their fences. And they would leave these threatening notes and letters at the site of these attacks. And at first it started with these black hands, La Mano Negra. Mm-hmm. And so historians have always considered, well, La Mano Negra was this Spanish anarchist group from the 1890s in Spain. These Spanish sheep herders must have migrated to northern New Mexico and taken up arms against the state here, which is a really, really interesting and dramatic story. But the evidence is really that these land grant activists, these people living in TA, were very, very sophisticated in their struggle, and they realized, well, the one thing that scares elites in New Mexico is the Ku Klux Klan. In the 1920s, the Klan became a powerful political force in the United States. The mayor of Denver, Stapleton, was a member of the Klan. Texas elected a Klan to the U.S. Senate. About 250,000 Texans were members of the Klan. the entire front range of Colorado in the 20s was taken over by the Klan, but the Klan couldn't make headway into New Mexico because of the sort of the racial alliance between an Anglo elite and a Spanish-American elite in New Mexico that saw themselves as distinct from a land-grant society. They were European. They were Spanish-American and not Mexican. And the Ku Klux Klan frightened elites in New Mexico for its ability to interrupt that racial alliance. And so land-grant activists, my argument in the book is, were very savvy about, well, what's the one thing that scares these elites in Santa Fe the most? And it was their political position based as much as it was around race, sort of the racial order in New Mexico is sort of unique in the Southwest. So they start calling themselves the Ku Klux Klan, which has confused the heck out of historians for years, because now why would this sort of Catholic Spanish-speaking enclave in northern New Mexico have anything in common with the Ku Klux Klan, who wanted nothing to do with them, right? So the book sort of tries to answer the question, like what was going on in northern New Mexico at this time? And you know that struggle led directly into years of legal struggles that made it to the New Mexico Supreme Court over TA, and four really interesting and fascinating court cases in which people were making really interesting and sophisticated legal arguments in defense of common property, and that's all part of this struggle that then leads to Tijerina in 67. He didn't walk into New Mexico and reignite the land grant movement. Right. He came into New Mexico with a political infrastructure in place of people that had been organizing for generations, and he took advantage of that and advanced it. I mean, he was a sort of a significant figure in his own right. But that stuff was there in a really fascinating way. I mean, the story is just so interesting that I know I'm an academic and I have to write these sort of scholarly books, but I try to get out of the way because the story is so fascinating.
Well, the story, it does read like a great Western. I mean, it does remind us kind of how we are in the Wild West there.
Truth is better than fiction.
Absolutely.
At least in New Mexico.
Certainly in northern New Mexico, that's true. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, this massive wave of dispossession, or really privatization of common land, which seemed to occur under the Santa Fe Ring? I mean, throughout history, of course, but this kind of ring.
Yeah. You know, the ring comes, in the 1880s, right after New Mexico became a territory of the United States in the 1840s, it was impossible for speculators to do anything with a huge forest or grazing lands or timber, because there were no way to get that out, and it isn't until the railroad arrives in the 1870s. So the usual stories that are told about the Santa Fe Ring in New Mexico are stories that, even if they're critical of the Santa Fe Ring, sort of celebrate their power and authority. These really wealthy Anglos, Catron and others, arrive and they completely dispossess all these people of their land, because the people that claim these Mexican and Spanish land grants are many often illiterate, don't speak English, don't understand the law. But when we really look at that history, which I try to do here, it's kind of a different story. First, the land grant communities were pretty sophisticated in their defense. They knew what was going on. They understood it. And the speculators were not quite as competent as they're made out to be. Most of them, even if they acquired the land, went bankrupt trying to make a profit from it. I mean, the Santa Fe National Forest and the Carson National Forest is really just a monument to their incompetence. They couldn't make any money, so they just sold it for a song to the U.S. and turned it into national forest. So the story of speculation is a story of dispossession, but it's really more a story of resistance to those patterns of speculation by powerful Anglo economic interests. It's true that money flowed into New Mexico from London and Amsterdam, but more often than not, and particularly in TA, the people living on those land grants were pretty effective in maintaining their claim to land. Even if you look in the archives and you see, oh, they lost the land, if you actually look and talk to people, you'll see that they stayed there. They didn't go anywhere. They maintained. They continued to use the land like they had. It's a different story than the Santa Fe Ring is so powerful and dispossessed everyone.
And the Corporación de Abiquiú?
Right.
Is this one of the resistant groups
Yes.
that filed claims? I mean, it sounds like these people were organized against a lot of the dispossessed.
Right.
That was
a group that
team.
Has never been written about before. The land grant residents in CA established this group in the 1930s, and they call it La Corporación de Abiquiú, the Corporation of Abiquiú. They took the name from the town council in Abiquiú during the Spanish period, because they came from Abiquiú, right? And they were the ones that took the land grant to court from the 30s all the way up to the 1960s, and even in the 70s, this group was still, you know, and they weren't just going to court. They were doing really provocative and dramatic things. They realized that the courts only recognize property as a performance. Right? In other words, you have to do things to be a property owner. You have to put up fences and no trespassing signs, and you have to dig wells and all those kinds of things. So they just started doing that. And they would just invade private ranchers' land because, you know, that was their common land, they claim. And they just plowed it and planted crops and dug acequias and dug wells and built fences. And it just befuddled these ranchers and even the courts who couldn't get their head around this idea that there was some other form of property relation than private. So they're doing these two things. They're mailing eviction notices to ranchers. If the ranchers don't pay the eviction notices, then they'll mail rental bills to the ranchers, you know, for 10 cents a head of cattle. And then they're filing ejectment suits and quiet title suits at district court and
this is very sophisticated.
Well, and they also had very good lawyers. They hired very good lawyers from Santa Fe and elsewhere. Harry Bigby was one of their lawyers, who was a former district judge. And, you know, it was their strategy. I mean, as I show in this chapter when I write about this, in the 1930s, they start organizing themselves, and they come up with this legal strategy. And then they hire these very sophisticated attorneys in Santa Fe and elsewhere and tell them, here's our strategy, put it into action. And they do. And it takes the courts, these judges, mostly in Santa Fe, have to just, the sort of legal acrobatics they have to go to reject these really legitimate claims is remarkable. And so in the book, I'm trying to show how the courts, time and again, are just telescoping back into the past, private relations that never existed and claiming they were always there, in ways that really stretch any sort of legal imagination as even legitimate. But by the 1960s, they have pretty much rejected the idea that there even ever existed common property relations. Even though on the ground, NTA, it was still going on. People were still, sharing access to the uplands and the commons. And so it was this disconnect between the law and between what's really happening in everyday life.
And so where are we today legally? You end the book with a chapter on this big development, Canyon Ridge, that's supposed to have multi-million dollar homes. And What's the status here?
Well,
and not specifically there, but in terms of the common-private kind of
right,
struggle.
Right. Well, you know, this is one of those stories that won't go away. What, you know, the conceit of the book is that private property is really not an object. It's not a thing. Private property is not a thing that a person claims, but rather it's a kind of social relation. Right. My ability to claim property is really my ability to exclude you, and the state enforces that. Exclusion. So in that way, property really puts me in relation to other people around me. And so in that sense, property is never finished. Property constantly has to be asserted and defended and enforced. And so what's happening today in TA is really just an extension of the struggle that's been going on for over 100 years. And it's different. And what's happening now is, for example, the Hickory Apaches are buying back. They were ejected in the 1870s, and now because of oil and gas money, they're slowly buying back part of the grant. And the real great irony of this is when they buy land adjacent to the reservation, they can deed that over to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who holds it for them in common. So in a sort of a really ironic way, the commons is returning to TA, but it's just not the commons.
Through private purchases.
Yeah, or through the Mexican land grant or the heirs that have it. And also there's this large-scale residential development that I examine in the book, which is another sort of irony, because these developers, this particular one developer, is also deeding all of this property to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And it's becoming another kind of commons. But this time it's just a commons for really, really, really rich people who could afford like a third or fourth home in the mountains above TA. And so these ironies just keep piling up when it comes to property in TA.
Now, you have written recently about the 46th anniversary of the courthouse raid. And let's talk a little bit about the memory, about the way that we talk about land grants here, because there seemed to be very little reference to the fact that this was native land first, and whose land it was. You also mentioned that the land grants built the Alianza on the backs of women who did much of the work but received none of the recognition. What are some of the stories that never appear when we talk about this land grant struggle?
Yeah, that was a piece I wrote for the Albuquerque Alibi on the anniversary of the raid. There's an Well, I have a good friend of mine, a historian at the University of California, Davis, Lorena Oropeza, is writing a biography of Tijerina. And she tells these great stories that, you know, Tijerina was became quite famous for these dramatic marches. He would be, you know, he would march from Albuquerque to Santa Fe to go to the governor's office to bring, you know, bring attention to the plight of land-grant heirs and everything. And, you know, he got all the attention and the accolades or the criticisms, right? And the way she sells it is, what was interesting is, there he is marching north of from Albuquerque to Santa Fe, but behind him was his wife and his kids carrying all the gear and the food and everything, right? And, you know, women did an enormous amount of work and received none of the recognition. And also, as I point out in the piece, I don't think that many land-grant activists have really come to terms with this history of Indian dispossession. Indian removal did serve as the condition for every single Spanish and Mexican land-grant, every one of them. And what does that mean? Well, Tijerina spent a lot of time trying to figure that out, and he came up with this idea that, you know, the conquerors and the conquered blood courses through our veins. That's the way he used to put it. And then that was, for most, I think, for many, that was about it. Oh, we covered that. We resolved that contradiction. But I think that it's much messier and more complicated, and the ethics of that history are important to take into account, which is what I'm trying to do in the book, to really figure out what happened and really who benefited from these violent campaigns of Indian removal. And what I find is it's, the people that were moving to places like Tierra Maria, these land-grant settlers, were just as much the victims of Spanish colonialism as the Utes that were being evicted, right? This was not... who benefited were the wealthy Spanish elites and later Mexican elites in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, who put these policies into practice and gave momentum to these violent histories of colonialism.
I'm speaking today with David Correa, assistant professor in the Department of American Studies at UNM. He is the author of the book Properties of Violence, Law, and Land-Grant Struggle in Northern New Mexico. He will be elaborating on this Sunday at Collected Works, part of the Journey Santa Fe series, starting at 11 a.m. We have a little time left, and I would actually like to ask you about some of your other work, which is as editor of an online magazine called La Jicarita on environmental politics in New Mexico. And you've written an article, I guess, last January about Governor Susana Martinez's quote-unquote unprecedented war on the environment. Can we just touch on that and that work that you do as well?
Yeah, we also, La Jicarita, which is, you can find it online, just do a Google search of La Jicarita, J-I-C-A-R-I-T-A, in New Mexico, and you'll find it. We actually have a relationship with the Alibi now in Albuquerque. And Wednesday I'll have a piece coming out in the Alibi on precisely this question. And so just briefly, really since she came into office in 2010, 2011, Susana Martinez has undone almost every possible environmental regulation governing industrial activity, agricultural activity, or extractive activity in the state of New Mexico, from the dairy pit rule that protected groundwater from manure lagoons to the oil and gas pit rule that protects groundwater. Many of those tanks were leaking, the open pits were leaking, thousands of them around the state. She undid that rule, and the copper pit rule governing mining, and the piece on Wednesday focuses on her very troubling relationship with Freeport-McMoRan, this mining giant that owns three copper mines in New Mexico, and is perhaps one of the, I would have to say, one of the most, the evilest corporation I've ever come upon. And read the piece to really, I think I make the argument for that. But, you know, she has basically sacrificed nature on the altar of corporate profits. And there has been some, I know that Laura Paskus wrote a great piece in the Santa Fe Reporter a couple of weeks back on this question, and others have covered it, but I think we have to see it in its entirety. The way in which she has undone environmental regulation is frightening for, I think, the state, both in terms of human health and non-human health. The groundwater quality has been sacrificed, I think, for her political expediency.
Well, I may need to have you back on the show to kind of elaborate on this, or perhaps you can also discuss this Sunday at 11 at Journey Santa Fe. Well, David, thank you so much. His new book is Properties of Violence. He will be speaking more about this Sunday, Journey Santa Fe, at 11 a.m. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll be speaking with Nadine Flores about resources available for the aging populations of northern New Mexico. Probably leads well onto this story. Thank you so much, David.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm speaking today with Nadine Flores, who works for the New Mexico Aging and Long-Term Services Department and is the State Health Insurance Assistant Program Coordinator for Northeastern New Mexico. She's here to talk about resources for the aging and disabled New Mexico. Also joining us is Stan Cooper, a volunteer with the New Mexico Aging and Long-Term Services Department. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, both of you.
Good morning.
So, Stan, you were telling me some really interesting statistics the other day that by 2030, the number of people over 65 will grow from 35 million to 70 million, and that New Mexico is the fourth fastest growing elder population in the nation.
And that's correct. It's a huge growth of the baby boomers are turning 65 every few seconds, and it's a huge growth. And, I think we have to get ready for that tsunami of people turning 65 to meet their needs in the future.
So, Nadine, is New Mexico ready for this? And what kind of programs do we have for the aging population?
Well, we do a lot with Medicare. We also do a lot with Medicaid. And there are some changes with the Centennial Care and the Affordable Care Act. So, starting October 1st, there will be a change and different things that we're still working on. But we're going to handle it to the best of our ability.
So what are some of the biggest challenges facing our aging population here?
Pretty much lack of resources in regards to the funding. So sometimes people don't have their medications. They're not able to afford their medications. They don't have enough money for food, things like that. So that's where the Resource Center comes into play, is that we have the MedBank program, which assists with the medications. And then we also have the paperwork to help them qualify for low-income subsidies, such as Medicare Savings Program. So that helps individuals with their deductibles, co-payments. And we also have the extra help through Social Security, which helps people pay for some of their prescriptions. So those are some of the main ones.
And is there a resource place that people can go? They can call. You have a website that I think the nmresourcedirectory.org?
Yes, that is the resource directory. But the main number that we do have, and this is throughout New Mexico, it's 1-800-432-2080. So anytime somebody calls in, they would be directed to a benefits counselor who can assist them over the phone. We also have SHIP coordinators, which is a State Health Insurance Assistance Program coordinator like myself, that we're situated throughout all of New Mexico. So if people want to meet with somebody like in a senior center, you just have to call the resource center, find out where the next SHIP coordinator is going to be, and they can do a one-on-one there. And we also do one-on-ones at the resource center here in Santa Fe. So if somebody's in the area and would like to come in and have a meeting with a counselor there, they can set that up as well.
Now, the big assumption here is that people have transportation, and I think one of the biggest difficulties for aging people really across the nation is that they cannot travel or they need somebody to take them where they go, and especially a place like New Mexico that's so spread out.
Yeah, that is a big issue, and here in Santa Fe, I think every community has senior programs, and a lot of the vans from the senior centers will take people to the doctor or shopping sometimes. But in Santa Fe, there's a Santa Fe Ride program. So if you're disabled, it's $2 one way each way, $5 if you're 60 and older, regardless of income. So there are some other options for people to get around. But transportation is huge. In northern New Mexico, we have the North Central Regional Transit District, the blue buses that move people around for free between Taos and Santa Fe, or Espanola and Santa Fe, to see the doctor. Now, dial a ride, which is you call a day ahead and get a ride. I think they do charge for some of that. But transportation is a big issue.
And let's talk about some of the other ones. You hear a lot of really horrible things about elder abuse.
Yes, we do have the Adult Protective Services intake line at the Resource Center. So there, if people are suspected of abusing, neglecting, or exploiting someone, they can call. Someone can call in, and it's what they do there is they do the report, okay, so it generates out of Santa Fe, but they will send it out to the respective county. So, for instance, if it's in Santa Fe, they will send it to Santa Fe County. They'll handle it there. If it's in Las Vegas, it would go to San Miguel County, and San Miguel County will handle it. So pretty much all people have to do is call the resource center, and they can report it. As long as they have a name, some good demographic information, they just have to have the, you know, situation reported, and then from there, they'll send it out. The main thing, though, with that is that people don't have to give their name. And sometimes people are afraid of that because they say, oh, no, once they find out I report it, then that's going to be, you know, retaliation. So people can remain anonymous for this. They do not have to give their name as long as they have a good story. Even if they don't have the exact address, if they can say it's on this area with this blue house, just some really, really good information, that would be a good enough to...
I mean, it's so hard for older people. I think that abuse in general is underreported kind of across the field, but there's a vulnerability getting old. I mean, getting old in this country is not something I'm looking forward to. I was looking through a lot of these statistics and seeing that in this area, New Mexico is not the worst off, which is shocking because we're the worst off in so many other areas. And I wondered if there was something about the community orientation of perhaps Hispanic culture here and Native culture that kind of brings people together.
Yes, I think a lot of times people just take care of each other. You know, they kind of, everybody's kind of like family. I know I work a lot in senior centers, and the senior centers are really, really helpful with their community and with the people that do attend. They kind of just make sure that they have their food and that they're getting their services. And if not, they know where to turn, you know. So oftentimes they'll call us and we can step in. But I do find that people do take care of each other. However, sometimes people don't want to be nosy, or they don't want to get involved, and then that's where these people fall through the cracks. So that's why we make it known that please report anything. It could even be something as simple as self-neglect. Maybe somebody is not able to take care of themselves, they're not taking their medications, or maybe they don't have air conditioning, you know, in this hot weather. So you can call in and report something like that. Nobody gets in trouble. It just falls under self-neglect. If Adult Protective Services step in, then they can provide the resources just to ensure that somebody, you know, gets what they need.
And right now, I think the percentage is 13.2% of our population,
right,
about is above 65, and that is expected to grow to 26.4%.
That's right. New Mexico will be the fourth largest percentage of 65 older in the country by 2030.
So this is an enormous jump. Do you know what that means in terms of numbers and where geographically they might be concentrated?
No, I don't. Yeah, there are lots of people moving into New Mexico because of the climate. You know,
right,
they want to retire. You meet people when I'm down in Las Cruces or from the Midwest who retired to the sun, and you know, in the Southwest.
Though we have had harsh winters in the past. What are they thinking?
Well, that's the southern part of the state, not the northern part.
Oh, I see.
So, yeah, I think it's, you know, the climate. There's more sun days than most states have, and... the climate's good. And as you mentioned earlier, I think the New Mexico legislature 20, 30 years ago, as Nadine said and you said, you know, they want to take care of each other and their relatives. It's high in the Hispanic culture to take care of mom, dad, or aunt. And so they put more money in state dollars into aging programs to augment the federal dollars out of the Old Americans Act. And I don't think every state does that, so we're fortunate for that.
Well, that's something we should note because we don't often get to, do we? But speaking of federal cuts, I think we have to mention sequester cuts. And this is massive across the country. It'll total about $1.2 trillion in cuts through fiscal year 2021. This year there's a 5.3% cut, totaling $85 billion. And a lot of this cut is impacting food programs. Now let's talk about food insecurity for older people.
Well, one out of eight older Americans, older adults, have food insecurity. That means they're not sure where their next meal is coming from. But you can call the Resource Center. There are a number of food banks here in Santa Fe that help people. One of them helps 3 or 4 days a week, another one 2 days a week. So there are a lot of efforts going on to help with that problem, but it's kind of astonishing to know that one out of eight senior citizens are concerned where their next meal is coming from.
I think the National Meal on Wheels even puts it at one in seven is wondering about the next meal. They say 40% eliminating staff positions, 50% reducing the number of seniors being served, about 70% cutting if service programs that didn't have waiting lists are now having enormous waiting lists, so they have to decide which older person gets a meal and which doesn't. Is this happening in New Mexico as well?
Yes, it does happen. But like Stan mentioned, there are the food pantries, so we do volunteer for those on a regular basis. Stan has actually organized all of that. So it does happen. I don't have the statistics on that, but it is something that we must not ignore. And that's why what we try to do is whatever paperwork, if it's food stamps, things like that, we try to assist people in filling out the paperwork, making sure, you know, that they are assessed for income guidelines, because a lot of times they might qualify for programs, but if they're not aware of it, then they don't even, you know, go forward. So our job is to try to kind of find.
And the other thing I think is, you know, if you work at one of these food pantries and you talk to people like Nadine and I do, and you meet someone who just came back from Social Security, they tried to sign up for supplemental security income to get a little cash, and where I'm here today at this food pantry, but until I get my SSI check, do you know of any other places I can go to get help? So we tell them about Bag in Hand Food Pantry on Opecos Trail.
So I'm sure a lot of this is about outreach, which is partly why you're here as well. But elder people are not as connected as everybody else. They don't have internet access. So how do you get the word out? How do you let people know that a lot of these things exist for them? Because I think more and more this is just really going to become difficult in this country.
Well, what we do is, as coordinators, we go out throughout the whole state of New Mexico. So like yesterday I was in Santa Rosa. Sometimes I'll be in Taos, Wagon Mound, Mora. I'm just all over the place. But not only that, we do a lot of advertising, and then we have people like Stan who volunteer. So, you know, there's only so much we can do, but with our volunteers, we get to, you know, go out and reach other areas. And so it's just a matter of getting the information to churches. We advertise the radio station. We do billboards, commercials, just here, there, and everywhere. Tell neighbor, word of mouth.
and I think it's important for the listening audience to know that if you're a 40 or 50-year-old son or daughter, that these resources are available. Maybe your parents aren't able to access these numbers and get online, but you know, as the son and daughters and relatives, they need to know about these resources because it's an 800 number away for help.
Well, I was going to say that so many people here depend on their caretakers, and caretakers very often have had to leave their own jobs and then don't really qualify as caretakers or can get paid. So how can people who are doing that, do they get resources here? Do they qualify for the same amount, or is it only the elder person?
It's the elder person. Yeah, and that is unfortunate. I mean, because there are programs such as the waivers, the Colts waiver that can assist with care. But a lot of it ultimately does fall down to private pay. So it's something that, you know, is the truth. It's the reality. And that's why whatever programs there are, they try to be assessed to see if they qualify. If not, it does come out of private pay. And that is unfortunate, but it is.
Well, especially in this economic situation, not many people can afford to leave their jobs to care for their loved ones.
And they're often living in other cities and other states. So that's why, you know, each state has a Department of Aging and some resource center information to help people across state lines, or helping someone whose parents live in Las Cruces and they're in northern New Mexico.
Now, you had mentioned that the government here had put a lot of money into building different senior centers or community centers, regardless of the name. Tell us a little bit about that, because it sounds like we have quite a few.
Well, I think there's about 300 senior centers in New Mexico, and every general election, there's a question on the ballot, general obligation bond, to help capital outlay. That's help senior programs get new buildings, and it's build senior centers and infrastructure. And that's unique. I think not other states have that ballot question every general election, and they always pass, or they have in the past, knock on wood. So that's an additional resource to help provide programs to seniors.
And this is a place where people can go and get a free hot meal. Is this correct?
Yes. Well, if you're 60 and older under the Older Americans Act, or maybe even younger, I'm not sure, maybe.
Yeah. It varies from place to place. Sometimes it's 55, unless you have a spouse that is 60.
Yeah, and they ask for, the regulations are they ask for a donation. You don't have to give anything. You can, but it's not a set price.
And they also have a good Meals on Wheels program. So for the people that cannot come out into the communities, they are delivered a hot meal Monday through Friday. And then sometimes they will give a frozen meal to go for the weekend. So, and again, like going back to that, senior centers are really helpful as far as kind of keying in as to who needs help. Because there are people that can't come out, and that is true. So I know what we do is if somebody is home-based, is we can do home visits as well. And that usually comes from the senior centers kind of alerting us that, hey, this person is really in need of services, but they can't leave their home. So then in turn, we can step in and assist, or even a simple phone call and mailing them the paperwork. We try to find ways. But I know there are a lot of, there's a lot of work to be done. But I have to say a lot of people really do care and really do the best that they can on alerting. Proper resources, the proper agency. So it's kind of a lot of word of mouth.
And would you say that you have enough staff to deal with that? I mean, you said one of the biggest challenges was the lack of resources. I mean, do we have enough here in New Mexico to deal with this population?
I think we could always use more help, and that's why we're always looking for volunteers as well. We do let people know. I know, you know, it is hard to volunteer, but sometimes, like look at Stan today. He set this up. He sets up a lot of programs. He's always at the food pantry.
Yeah.
And we have other volunteers that do that. So if anybody's ever interested, we can certainly use the help, even if it's just getting an application sent to a person, giving the brochure, giving the right phone number, going to maybe their church on a Sunday,
right,
and getting the word out. So I think there's always going to be a lack of people, lack of assistance, but we're always here to try.
And it's so important. I'm speaking today with Nadine Flores and Stan Cooper, both of whom Nadine works. Stan volunteers for the New Mexico Aging and Long-Term Services Department in the state. So of all of the stories that you may have encountered here, are there particularly positive ones or also places where you see big holes in terms of the access and the help for old people?
Well, I think there are positive things happening every day, and we don't know what those are. But I think one of the things, I was at a food pantry about a week ago, and it's very low-income, homeless people who are really needy. And, you know, if they can find out where the next resource is that can get them through tomorrow, you know, you feel good about talking to those kind of people and referring them to the Aging and Disability Resource Center in the state. And those stories, and then they word of mouth with other people they know. So I think there are little bits of good things happening, and I'm positive that we can continue doing better work.
Well, thank you both so much. I'm speaking with Nadine Flores and Stan Cooper, who work for the New Mexico Aging and Long-Term Services Department. Can you just quickly repeat the 800 number people can call if they have questions?
Yes, it's 1-800-432-2080.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Zaylee, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.